4 of JMLB.
Just the vibe. As soon as we walked in the front door, it was like you got a sense of being welcomed, you know, and not pressured to come in, you know. And then you walk into the auditorium, and you know, we were about 2 minutes late, so we were already singing, and you know, and I'm like, this is good. My favorite part is actually begins on Saturday.
Okay.
You know, it's not, are we going to go to church, or man, we have to go to church tomorrow. You know, the whole family gets together and we're like, are we going to the 9 or are we going to the 11? You know, and that's the argument that we have.
That's awesome.
You know, is 9 or 11. So I just look forward to Sundays now and being able to come in and hear what's happening and singing,
yeah.
You know, and then just being able to just listen and learn,
right.
And then be able to put what we hear into our everyday life. Throughout the week, and not just on Sunday, throughout the week as I'm experiencing life experiences,
yeah.
You know, it's just, I'm starting to put what we learn in church and putting Jesus into it, you know, and being like, yeah, this is why, you know, and you know, it just makes me, it's not just a Sunday thing for me,
yeah.
And, you know, it's an everyday thing.
That's awesome.
We share a mutual friend, and he lost his boy, and the boys played ball together, and when we joined the team, we were actually told by the coach, this young man has cancer,
yeah.
He doesn't play, but he's always got a spot.
Yeah.
You know, and he wasn't going to be able to play, you know, and then one day, you know, we found out that it was gone.
Yeah.
You know, and he got to play again.
Yeah.
And he got to bat and he got to score a run.
Yeah.
You know, and then it, unfortunately it came back.
Yeah.
You know, and he lost his battle. But in my mind, you know, God reached down and said, hey, you
right.
know, you're going to play one more time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There we go. So Jimmy's story. And Jimmy is actually Colby's dad, who we heard from a few weeks ago. And it's just been incredible to see that whole family's lives being transformed by the love and the grace of Jesus. And I've loved, I don't know how you found, but I've loved hearing those testimonies every week for JMLB. And it's just great to hear stories of what God is doing in our community. But hi, welcome E Hills. Hello. Yes, why don't you turn to someone, give them a fist pump or a high five. There we go. Say hi. If you're new, if you are visiting, welcome. If this is your first time, we're so glad you're here. If you're joining us online, welcome. I know we've got people watching from all around the world. And it's just good to be together. And if you don't know, my name is Tom. I'm one of the pastors here. And we're in a series called JMLB. I'm going to dive kind of straight in to week 4 as we wrap this series up today. And I want to read to you from an excerpt from a book by Arthur Brooks called Strength to Strength. And Arthur Brooks is a social scientist. He's an author. And he writes about, in the opening chapter of this book, he writes about a man on a plane who changed his life. And so let me read to you that story. Let me open it up here on my fancy Android phone. Let me just show you how you see. Oh, wow. Wow. Boo. Boo. You Apple snobs. Okay. Inviting everyone. Okay. So this is what he says. It's a conversation overheard. It's not true that no one needs you anymore. These exacerbated words came from an elderly woman sitting behind me on a late night flight from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. The plane was dark and quiet, and most people were either sleeping or watching a movie. I was working on my laptop, feverishly trying to finish something now completely lost to memory, but that at the time seemed of crucial importance to my life, happiness, and future. A man I assumed to be her husband murmured almost inaudibly in response, and again the wife responded, Oh, stop saying it would be better if you were dead. Now they had my full attention. I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but I couldn't help it. I listened half with the human empathy and half with the fascination of a social scientist. I formed an image of the husband in my head. I imagined someone who had worked hard his whole life in relative obscurity, someone disappointed at his dreams unfulfilled, perhaps the career he never pursued, the schools he never attended, the company he never started. Now I imagined he was forced to retire, tossed aside like yesterday's news. As the lights switched on after touchdown, I finally got a look at the desolate man. I was shocked. I recognized him. He was well known, famous in fact. Then in his mid-80s, he had been universally beloved as a hero for his courage, patriotism, and accomplishments of many decades ago. I had admired him since I was young. As he passed up the aisle of the plane behind me, passengers recognized him and murmured with veneration. Standing at the door of the cockpit, the pilot recognized him and said, echoing my own thoughts, "Sir, I have admired you since I was a little boy." The older man, apparently wishing for death just a few minutes earlier, beamed at the recognition of his past glories. And I wondered to myself, which more accurately describes the man? The one filled with joy and pride now, or the one 20 minutes ago telling his wife he might as well be dead? And he never reveals the identity of that famous person. But like I said, we're in this series called JMLB. Someone asked me before the service, what does that stand for? It stands for Jesus Makes Life Better. But that statement is part of a much bigger statement, a statement of belief, a mission statement around here that goes like this: inviting everyone, say everyone,
everyone.
And everyone means everyone, inviting everyone to experience that following Jesus makes life better. That is who we are. That's our DNA. That's our mission. It's why we exist. And so over the past few weeks, we've been kind of unpacking that mission statement and breaking it down into bite-sized chunks. And so in week one, I looked at what it means to invite everyone to be a church that is welcoming and open to all people, because the message is for all people. In week two, we looked at what it means to experience those next two words, to experience, not just know about God, but actually experience him in our day-to-day lives, his presence and his power. And then last week, we looked at what does it mean to follow Jesus. We looked at the impact that Jesus has had throughout history, regardless of who you say he was or whether you believe he rose from the dead, the impact Jesus had on our society and the impact that he has on our lives. And so today, I want to wrap up this series by looking at the last three words in that statement, and that is, makes life better. Say better.
Better.
Better. Okay, I got to get that. Got to get that ER going there. Better, okay. But here's the truth. We all want a better life. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's part of what makes us humans, part of our genetic wiring. We are designed to seek better and more, to look for new and better ways of doing things, to try and make things more efficient, more effective, to try make things better. And even if you love your life, even if things are going really well, better is always an option that is there in front of us. Always room for improvement. The problem is, what is better? Is better bigger? Is better faster? Is better happier? Is it more? Is it more stuff? Is it more experiences? Is it more joy? Is it less worries? What is better? And what better are you looking for in your life today? Is it a better relationship with your kids or your spouse or your parents? Is it more financial freedom, more financial peace? Is it less anxiety and more joy, more self-confidence? What is better for you? Because if we don't have a clear expectation of or definition of what better is for us, then I fear we will be constantly disappointed. You see, we'll say often around here that Jesus makes life better, not easier, but better. And the reason we say that is that Jesus never promises us an easier life. In fact, he promises us the exact opposite. He says in the scriptures, in this world, you will have trouble. Not you might have trouble, you will have trouble. In other words, Jesus is giving us a heads up. Life is not easy. I mean, I don't need to tell you this, you know that. And then Jesus goes even further. He says, because you do not belong to the world and I have chosen you out of it, the world will hate you because of me. So if you're exploring faith, please don't become a Christian if you're looking for an easier life. If you're looking for a fulfilling life, a meaningful life, a purposeful life beyond yourself, then that's the life Jesus invites us to step into, but not an easier one. You with me? So then how do we define better? Because how we define better matters. And so the way I want to do that is I want to define mostly by what better is not. In order to define what better is, and in order to do that, I want to look at a famous passage of scripture. It's found in Paul's letter to the church in Philippi, Philippians chapter 4, and he's writing to a small gathering of Christ followers in the first century, and this is what he has to say. He says this, "I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret," say secret, "of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do this all through him who gives me strength." Now, bear this in mind. Paul is writing this letter from a prison cell. He's been imprisoned for his faith. And so you could say, in our view, hey, things aren't going good for him, but he's writing these words. He says, "I found the secret of being content in any and every situation, good or bad," which means here's the first clue that better is not attached to our situation or our circumstances. He says, "whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want," which is a second clue that better is not attached to more or less material things. Let me put this in the language of America, okay? The first thing I would say when we seek to define what better is and what better is that better is not bigger. Woo. This is the holy cow. If I was on Texas now, I'd be getting stoned, okay? Because I've seen the size of your trucks. You don't need six wheels on anyway, but we ordered a breakfast burrito the other day, Jess and I. They had to literally carry it in with like three people. Like, I mean, a lot of chickens had to sacrifice eggs for that breakfast burrito. It's unbelievable. I thought, how can one person eat? Anyway, better is not always bigger, and it's not always more, because guess what? More is never enough. If you know just one Rolling Stones song from the 1965 mega hit, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." Shout out to all the old people in the room, okay? It's one of the most popular songs of all time, not just because it's a great piece of music, but because it states a truth about life, that somewhere deep down in our primitive lizard brains, what scientists would call our limbic system, way below our level of consciousness, satisfaction is defined by this deviously simple equation, primitive equation, that satisfaction equals getting what we want. And if that sounds oversimplified or you don't believe me, just give a baby some ice cream and see what happens. We've actually got proof. Have you seen that meme, that video that's going around? This is the first time ever tasting ice cream. What is this sugar? You know, it's like, I love that expression. And that's the expression I saw on some of your faces after our 24 hours of fasting last week when you ate those cookies out there. I mean, and as much as we deny it, that is more or less the same expression you got on your face when you got that new car or that promotion at work. You really wanted it, you worked for it, and when you got it, the reward was deeply satisfying. Deeply satisfying, that is, for a couple of days at most. And that's the real problem, isn't it? The song, the Rolling Stones song, should have been titled, "I Can't Keep No Satisfaction." Because let's be honest, we know more or less how to meet our desire for satisfaction, but we're terrible at making it last. It's almost as if our brains won't let us enjoy anything for very long. And that's actually, on a biological level, exactly what's happening. It's what scientists often refer to as homeostasis. And I'm no scientist, but homeostasis is the natural tendency of all living systems to try to maintain equilibrium, stable conditions in order to survive. And that is a very good thing. It keeps us alive and healthy. It also explains how drugs and alcohol kind of get their hooks in us. Because if you've ever dealt with addiction, you know when you have a stiff drink or a shot of heroin for the first time, it's a massive shock to your body's system, which is why addicts always pine for that first time feeling. And it's not just hard drugs. It's why, you know, Starbucks talks in its marketing about that first sip feeling. I never drank coffee growing up or even as a young adult. I had my first sip of caffeine, of coffee, when I was 33 years old. Shock and horror, okay? I'm now 42, so it's been 9 years. But I remember when I had that first shot, Jess is nodding. It was like a double espresso, I don't know. I was bouncing off the walls for hours. She was like, what is wrong with you? I was like shaking, I couldn't sleep. Now I'm completely converted. I'm a coffee snob. I even have my own little espresso machine at home. And let me tell you, I can drink coffee all day and still not get that same feeling. Because while that first sip, that first bump or hit might give you pleasure, your brain senses the assault on its equilibrium and fights back to neutralize the entering drug, making it impossible to get that first sip feeling back. Now, some of you are thinking, what has this got to do with Jesus makes life better? Okay, just hang on there. I'm getting there. But you see, the same principle works on our emotions. When you get an emotional shock, good or bad, your brain wants to re-equilibrate, making it hard to stay on a high or a low for very long. And this is especially true when it comes to our positive emotions, which is why when it comes to success or seeking contentment from success, you can't ever get enough, because once you've achieved that thing, eventually that thing becomes normal and you need something else, something more to get the same level of satisfaction. Am I speaking to anyone? And so here's the danger. If we base our sense of self-worth on success, on whatever success looks like for you, what bigger is better, then you tend to go from victory to victory simply to avoid feeling awful. And this is just homeostasis at work. The buzz from success is neutralized quickly, and you're even left with a hangover feeling, knowing that you'll be looking for that bump again very soon. Your brain kind of adjusts to a feeling of anti-success. And so after a while, you need constant success just to not feel like a failure. I'll prove it to you. Right now, if you think about your life and where you are today, right now, you have already achieved goals you said would make you happy. You have already achieved goals you said would make you happy. Even for us, I mean, we prayed and longed and dreamed of this day coming to America and standing here and being part of this community. And now we're here, and it's so easy just to be like, okay, what's next? Instead, just step back and marvel at the miracle of it all. You've already achieved goals you said would make you happy. So the question is, are you happy, or have you just moved on to the next thing? This is what social scientists refer to as the hedonic treadmill. It's this treadmill that just keeps going. I'm gonna call my oldest son, Will, up, and this is why he's gonna run. We've got a treadmill here. You've got to work here around here, bro, if you want your lunch, okay? So let's give Will a hand. He's come prepared, and this boy is fast. And this is why I'm glad I had kids, so I don't have to do this part of the illustration. Okay, so you ready? Okay, we're gonna start you off on like a level 3 there, okay? You good, okay. Don't get distracted now, okay. I mean, this is one of the oldest treadmills I think I've ever seen. This is literally the treadmill that Jesus ran on. But but here's the thing about the hedonic treadmill. You run and you run and you run, but you still make no progress. You don't go anywhere. Does this feel like I'm describing your life? You get up, you take the kids to school, you prepare a meal, you pay the bills, and we do it all over again, and it feels like we're getting nowhere. And so now the equation becomes not just satisfaction is getting what you want. Now satisfaction is continually getting what you want. Now you've got to keep up. And so the carrot that's dangled in front of you, whatever that is, that fleeting feeling that you've made it or you've arrived, despite the fact that emotionally you're running in place on the hedonic treadmill, and it gets much worse. Don't worry about him, he'll be fine. Okay. Now the dissatisfaction problem compounds, because as you're getting more and more tired, as the more weak, the carrot gets further and further away, despite the fact that you're running faster and faster. Check, he's trying to act cool now. Okay, let's give him a hand. That's top speed. I can't go any faster. Thank you, bro. All righty, you can go, you're allowed to eat lunch now. Okay. But we just kind of get into this cycle, and we think that it's normal because everyone else is running, and we look aside us and we're all kind of running, and this is what we do, right? And we're just accumulating more and bigger is better and more stuff. I saw this image the other day. It's an old one, but it's a guy on his deathbed and he's lying there and he says this, I should have bought more crap. And it's funny because it's true. And statistics prove that successful people often keep working to increase their wealth, accumulating far more than they could possibly spend on their own or even bequeath to their children. And when asked why, here's one rich person, he responded, he says, many people who have gotten rich know how to measure their self-worth only in material terms. So they stay on the hedonic treadmill of earning and acquiring year after year, hoping that at some point they will finally truly feel successful, happy, and thus ready to die. But it never works. Bigger is not better. It's not faster, but we are hardwired to think it is. And it gets worse. There is good news coming, I promise. But for now, it gets worse because you see, when you're talking about satisfaction, particularly from success, there's another element to consider, and that is success is relative. I mean, there are people with hundreds of millions of dollars who feel like failures because their friends have billions and billions of dollars. There are famous Hollywood celebrities who famously will talk about their depression because someone else is more famous than them. And I think we all know that social comparison is ridiculous and it's harmful. You know, comparison is the thief of joy, but that keeping up with the Joneses only leads to anxiety and depression. And yet we keep doing it. And so then, even when we do achieve some level of wealth or success, whatever that is, that small rush of pleasure that we get from being envied by others one minute is swallowed up by the unhappiness of having less than someone else the next minute. And so now we get a new equation that success is not just, or satisfaction is not just getting what you want continually. Now success is continually having more than others. In other words, satisfaction from success requires not just that you continually run in place on the hedonic treadmill, but that you run slightly faster than the people running on theirs. I'm kind of laboring this point because I want us to remember this illustration and the ridiculousness of it all. And yet, this is how we build our societies. This is why we need better math, a better equation. And Arthur Brooks, the social scientist, proposes, I think, a great one. It echoes the truth in Scripture. He says this, before you abandon all hope, here's the good news. Satisfaction is possible, just not with the old formulas. We need to toss out the bad math and use this one equation instead. Satisfaction equals what you have divided by what you want. Think about that. Some of you, you just heard math and equation and your eyes just glaze over like, oh, math. I didn't want to come. But listen, this is important. Because what it boils down to is that we learn how to manage our wants and be grateful for our haves. Hello? To manage our wants and be grateful for our haves. Because you can make the wants, if you just keep increasing the wants at the bottom, it's only gonna decrease the size of the equation. This is the best of what modern social sciences teaches us. But guess what? It sounds very similar to what the Apostle Paul wrote thousands of years before. With all this social science, and I love this stuff, but with all this in mind, listen again to Paul's words. He says, I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. Regardless of whatever that equation does, I've managed my wants and I'm grateful for my haves. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. But then, he gives us what no social science could ever give us. He gives us the how. He gives us the why, the engine behind it all. And he says this powerful line, I can do all this through him who gives me strength. And the him is Jesus. Because Jesus makes life better. Better is not bigger. It's not more success. It's not more stuff. But it is better. You still with me? Okay, second thing I think that better is not, that we need to reframe in our context and our culture, is that better is not happier. Now, this is a hard one because this seems very counterintuitive and most definitely countercultural. But hear me out. I did some word studies this week on the original Greek that Paul is writing this letter in, and there were a couple words that jumped out at me, and I can't believe I've never seen this before, but the verb that he uses in the statement, I've learned the secret, it comes from the Greek mysterion, which is where we get the English word mystery. And the fact that Paul says we had to learn it, that it means that this does not come naturally to the human heart. It is uncommon. It is rare. That's why he calls it a secret. And like any mystery or secret, it must be discovered. Paul did not say, I have heard that in every state I should be content, but I have learned. And that means that this is something that must be done, practiced intentionally. Managing our wants, keeping a tab and a control on our desires, and choosing gratitude for what we have. Because make no mistake, it is a choice. It's an intentional decision that we must make every day. And I promise you this, I don't know what you're going through right now. I don't know what sadness you carry in your heart or what challenges lie before you, but I do know this, in every situation and in every circumstance, there is always something to be grateful for. Even if that's just food on your plate and a roof over your head, there's always something to be grateful for. And not many people figure this out. That's why Paul says it's a secret. The second word that jumped out at me in the Greek is the word that Paul uses for the word content. And it's a Greek word called artakis, or I don't know if I'm saying it right. And this is where it gets wild, because this word that Paul uses only appears once in the entire Bible. Now, the idea of contentment and happiness appears all over the place, but this specific word, Paul chooses a specific word in a specific sentence, because the word artakis for contentment is far more than just mere happiness. Are you following? It comes from two root words, autos and archaeo, which means to ward off or to raise a barrier. Again, it implies this idea of being intentional about it. And what Paul is saying is that contentment is not primarily an emotion, it is a skill. Hello? It is not an emotion or a feeling, it is a skill. And a skill is something that needs to and can be developed. Learning to be content is not about seeking out situations that will make us happy, it's about learning to be happy regardless of the situations. This is the secret. And again, Paul knows what he's talking about because he's writing this from a prison. And he's being very, very candid here. He's saying, guys, this did not come naturally to me, and it was not automatically given to me by God. It was a discovery process. It was a spiritual discipline that I had to discover by develop by walking with God every day through some pretty crazy challenges and situations. If you know Paul's story, shipwrecked multiple times, lost everything. So better is not happier, because it's deeper than happiness. It's a joy and a contentment that goes beyond our circumstances. And in my humble opinion, it can only be found in God. A few verses earlier, Paul writes this in the same letter. He says, do not be anxious about anything. How many of you are anxious about something? Pretty much everyone. Do not be anxious about anything. Instead, pray about everything. That's not to say prayer is like just a magic wand, but there's something about it that shifts our perspective. That's why we just went through a period of 24 hours of prayer and fasting. And let me say this, especially for those of you who struggle with anxiety. Anxiety itself is not a sin, it's a sign. It's not a sin, it's a sign that we need to pay attention to something. It's a sign that something is wrong, and that may be a chemical imbalance and you need to get professional help, and medication is a great way to help with that. But it is definitely an area of your life that you're struggling to trust God fully in. So often the things we worry most about reveals the thing we trust God the least in. Hello? For me, this often appears around our finances. When I start getting anxious about money, when I start holding tighter and tighter and trying to control and, you know, coming down hard on Jess when she's bought 2-ply instead of 1-ply or whatever, you know. You only get 3 squares, bro, every person, you know what I mean? You got to, no. I know when I start getting like that, when I start tightening things down, I know it's a sign that I need to surrender again and trust that God is my provider, that he loves me, that he knows me best, and he knows what I need. And he'll give me what I need, not always what I want, but what I need. Contentment does not depend on what I have. It depends on who I am, on who we are. In fact, on who God is and who we are in him. It's a spiritual attainment, not something that results from more purchasing power. Someone said, contentment is a state of the heart rather than a statement of account. And you know what? Here's the cool thing about all of this. A little bit of contentment goes a long way. Sounds like Mary Poppins, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. A small bit of contentment has a huge impact on every aspect of your life. It has the power and the potential to change everything, every situation, every relationship, every season you find yourself in. When instead of complaining about what you lack, you start focusing on what you have. Instead of complaining about the person, you know, if she did this and he didn't do this, then I wouldn't. And we started to see the good side and celebrate that. It's amazing what it can do. Hello? Charles Spurgeon said this, a little sprig of the herb called content put into the poorest soup will make it taste as rich as the Lord Mayor's turtle. Now, I don't know who the Lord Mayor is and why he has a rich turtle, but anyway, it just sounded cool, okay? You get what he's saying? A little bit of contentment goes a long way. Better is not happier. It's deeper than that. Just like we heard the story from Jimmy about that baseball kid who sadly passed away from cancer. No, that story did not end the way anyone hoped it would. But in the midst of it, joy was found in the blessing and the beauty of a community that came around that family, that loved him, and that he got to play that game again with his teammates, and that through it all, God was with him. See, Christianity tells me not so much that I have an answer for suffering, but rather a companion in it. And I think in the end, that matters far more. Jesus did not come to make life happier. He came to make life better. But I'll tell you this, please hear me. His better will always far exceed your happier that you could ever conjure on your own. One more quote on this from C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite authors. He says this, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. Better is not bigger, better is not happier, and finally, better is not selfish. Jesus came to make life better, 100%. But that better was never just meant for me or for you or for us, or for my family, or my children, or my children's children. No, the blessing of God was meant for all people. All people. In fact, you would argue that if it's only better for a few and not for everyone, then is it really better at all? I mean, my context is apartheid, where for many, many years, life was better for a very small percentage of the population with skin color like mine. It certainly wasn't better for all. Jesus came to make life better for everyone. And that is why the full statement is inviting everyone to experience that following Jesus makes life better. Sometimes people who kind of are wrestling with faith or have objections to faith, and I had these objections for many years, but they would say things like, you know, how can a good God send people to hell? And I always respond with this, God is not trying to send anyone to hell. 2 Peter 3 verse 9 tells us his desire is that none should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Do I believe in hell? Yes, but not the hell that we so often picture in our society, or that, you know, the Disney version of hell with the little red devil and the pitchfork and the tail and the fire. That's nowhere in the Bible, by the way. Eternal separation from God, yes, but not because God sends people there, rather because people choose to be there and they choose it now. We talk about hell on earth. And God, in his grace, allows us this choice. Again, C.S. Lewis says it so much better than I ever could. I'm quoting a lot of Lewis today. He says, there are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says, in the end, thy will be done. All that are in hell choose it. Without that choice, there would be no hell. And then he ends this quote. Please hear this, especially if you're wrestling with faith. No soul that seriously desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find, and those who knock, it is opened. All that to say, if we truly want to experience the better life that God offers to us, that is life that starts now and continues on to eternity, then you have to make your life about more than just you. And honestly, I don't know how to do that without God's help, because I'm pretty selfish. So are you. So are we all. The only way I know how to do this is by saying to God, God, give me a heart for others. Help me to see others through your eyes. Help me to see them as made in your image with infinite worth and value. Help me to be less selfish. Break my heart for what breaks yours. Move me towards compassion, because I can't do this on my own. This will not come naturally to my heart. I have to fight for it. I have to contend for it every day. And that's actually my only application point for today, taken straight from Philippians chapter 4. And that is this, that we would contend for contentment. See what I did there? That we would contend for contentment, that we would fight for it. Not happiness, not fleeting pleasure, but contentment. That we would cultivate gratitude, that we would cultivate thankfulness, that we would cultivate contentment and not get sucked into the bad math of our world, believing the lies that satisfaction is having more, you know, continually getting what I want or continually having more than others. But that we would remember that simple equation, satisfaction is what you have divided by what you want. That we would manage our wants and be grateful for our haves. That we would pursue contentment, not just happiness, and make our life about others. Because make no mistake, we reap what we sow. Selfishness, discontent, complaining, criticizing, comparing, these things will come naturally to us. They're like weeds that will pop up. They just spring out of the earth with no effort. We don't need to teach our kids to complain, right? They complain fast enough without any education. That's what I found. Okay, can I get an amen? Okay, make me feel like I'm not alone. Love you, my boy. Okay. But the precious things of earth must be cultivated. If we want to reap a harvest, then we must plow and we must sow. Why would you expect a healthy marriage or a healthy sex life if you're not sowing seeds of intimacy and affection? Why would you expect a healthy bank account if you're not sowing seeds of financial stewardship? If we want to reap, we must plow and we must sow. If we want flowers, well, then there must be a garden and the gardener's care. And contentment is one of the flowers of heaven. If we would have it, it must be cultivated. We must contend for it by rooting up the weeds of self-centeredness and selfishness. So what does that look like for you today? What is the better that you're longing for? A better relationship with someone, maybe you're even thinking of them now. Better mental health? Is it maybe the learning to respond better to the things that trigger you and stress you out? And maybe, just maybe, is it possible that the better that you've been looking for is different from the better that Jesus wants to give you? And I promise you, his better is far better than my better. Does that make sense? It's so much bigger. It's so much grander. So as we wrap things up today, I want to end by telling you a bit of a legend. It's a legend taken from this passage of scripture we've been exploring, Philippians 4. And the legend has it that a wealthy merchant during Paul's day had heard about this apostle and had become fascinated with him, that he determined to visit him in prison. And so when passing through Rome, he got in touch with Timothy, Paul's friend, and he arranged an interview with Paul the prisoner. And stepping inside that dark and damp cell, the merchant was surprised to find the apostle looking old and physically frail. But he felt at once the strength, the serenity, the vibrancy, and the magnetism of this man who relied on Christ as his all in all. And they talked for some time, and finally the merchant left. And outside the cell, he asked Timothy, he said, "What is the secret of Paul's power? I've never seen anything like it before." "Did you not guess?" replied Timothy. "Paul is in love." And the merchant looked puzzled and said, "In love?" "Yes," said Timothy. "Paul is in love with Jesus Christ." And the merchant looked even more confused. And he says, "Is that all? I mean, there's got to be more than that, surely." And Timothy simply smiled and replied, "My friend, that is everything. That is everything." So if you're able, I'm going to ask you to stand right where you are, and we're going to sing one last song together. And just before we sing this song, if you'd allow me to, I'm going to ask you just to bow your heads, close your eyes, if you're comfortable. And I'm going to pray a Franciscan blessing over you. It's a 16th century blessing. And even as I say the words, it may not feel like a blessing, but it really is. And so may God bless you with discomfort at easy answers, half-truths, and superficial relationships, so that you may live deep within your heart. May God bless you with anger at injustice, oppression, and the exploitation of people, so that you may work for justice, freedom, and peace. May God bless you with tears to shed for those who suffer pain, rejection, hunger, and war, so that you may reach out your hand to comfort them and turn their pain to joy. And may God bless you with enough foolishness to believe that you can make a difference in this world, so that you can do what others claim cannot be done. And then finally, this is my own addition. May God bless you with more than just success or happiness, but with a deep contentment, so that you may learn the secret, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want, and may you do it all through Him who gives us strength. Let's sing together.